Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The U.S. Congress accuses Brussels of election interference, not the Russians. The partisan political war raging inside and across the West continues. Also, negotiations in Abu Dhabi and Oman. Are they meaningful exercises or merely kabuki theater? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which we found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark. You know, the following Congress's hearings on election machinations and censorship control, there's been an interesting caveat here that it's apparently it's not really the Russians that are interfering elections, particularly in Europe. It's the EU, Brussels bureaucracy. Now, the U.S. Hearings on this, we have to keep in mind that this is at least partially at the behest of Elon Musk, because his platform is being attacked repeatedly in Europe. And I want to talk about platform control at the end of this segment here. But what's going on here? It's kind of interesting. It's the Russians have been pushed aside when it comes to interference. Mark.
Well, I mean, color me shocked at that score.
Yeah, totally shocked.
It's nice to see that the U.S. Congress is caught up with us, you know, months and years from there. But, you know, maybe they've been watching and have learned something. But this report is actually, I think, a direct follow-up to what we heard declared in the Trump administration's new national security strategy, where they, in effect, declared political war on the Brussels liberal technocracy. And now, this isn't the first shots fired in that affair, at least as far as Trump and his administration are concerned. The liberal Brussels technocrats have been opposed to him in the United States and have sided with his political opponents and have at times openly interfered in U.S. elections in support of his opponents, whether that was Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden's corpse, or Kamala Harris. So he sees this as a bit of payback. And in the national security strategy, it was announced that the U.S. was essentially going to seek political regime change, color revolution tactics in Europe. Why? Because their perception, and which is absolutely fair in this regard, that the Brussels liberal technocrats were repressing and suppressing populist right political parties across Europe, in Romania, in Germany, the AfD, in France, the National Rally Party, and anyway, everywhere.
And Slovakia and Moldova.
Slovakia and the Netherlands. Yes, multiple countries. Moldova's not even a part of the EU, but right. I guess they're thrown in for bonuses there. Now, Europeans are, of course, extremely upset about this. They see it as an interference in their control of the EU, while the Trump administration is looking for like-minded political allies to bring to power in Europe. This is partisan. It is at a right-left populist hegemonic center intersection. It is sub-geopolitical. This isn't affecting the West's foreign geopolitical or foreign policy in other way. This is all happening. I mean, it's in the open, but it's still under the covers.
Yeah, but George, also, you know, we've over the years, as Mark's pointed out, I mean, always claiming there's Russian interference in elections here, when we over and over again said, yes, there's interference, but it's coming from the EU. But, you know, this interference, this is a kind of a sub issue to the biggest one, and it is narrative control. It is a censorship. OK, they want to keep the center left, center right paradigm in power that is failing miserably for the populace. That's why it's mostly, and this will be a topic for another program, what happened to the left in Europe, but it's against populism here. And it's all under the proviso that the evil Russians are doing it. And even the Americans are picking up, and as Mark has pointed out, they're meddling in American elections. The UK isn't in the EU any longer, but they meddle as well. George.
Yes, they do. And obviously, they meddled in 2016 and they meddled in 2020 and they meddled in 2024. Now, the Digital Services Act that was introduced by the EU, it is absolutely all about just censoring political speech. And they do it precisely with a view to ensuring that there is no popular uprising against the rule of the unelected EU bureaucracy. But of course, the underlying it all is the threat from Russia. And of course, they present it as, child pornography. Yeah. Apparently it's, ubiquitous, even though no one actually ever sees it. And of course, they use this in order to, keep everything under control. Now, in the case of the United States, they actually explicitly use these social media platforms precisely to interfere in the U.S. election. Because if you recall, there was Thierry Breton, the EU commissioner for the internal market at that time, issued a warning to Elon Musk. Well, you better not interview presidential candidate Donald Trump at the time, because he might say something that is going to be in violation of the Digital Services Act. And Musk nonetheless went ahead with that interview. But ever since then, of course, the EU has been hitting the X. And of course, it's also been hitting Telegram. They want to bring Telegram under control. So all of this is without question, how do we control things? So hate speech, we have to eliminate hate speech, which of course they never define, because you can say anything is hate speech, and they do this explicitly. If any populist politician expresses ideas like, well, I don't think we should have LGBTQ education in public schools, that's hate speech. And so this is absolutely a blatant attempt at election interference, not just in the U.S., but everywhere in Europe.
Also, Mark, it's about who controls these platforms. The Europeans, Brussels has made it very clear that government or quasi-government institutions, an NGO should police platforms that are American. They're not European platforms. We have the same debate in the United States. It's not a government controlled. You can make your own rules, but that tends to bleed into where you have private companies legislating what speech laws should be allowed or not. This is a collision of different philosophies about how we can express ourselves online. Mark.
Yeah, this is a public-private partnership arrangement, ironically very similar to what the U.S. often uses with its own intelligence and counterintelligence in the United States. But often this falls under the guise of fact checkers, quote unquote, right? And this is this Orwellian idea of truth and information control, which, as you pointed out, the key words here is narrative control, right? It is only the Brussels liberals technocrats narrative that is allowed to be published. Why? Because they're afraid of their own people. They're afraid that
they want to stay in power.
They're afraid if their people hear another perspective, they might think differently. And the active part of all of this, securitization angle that justifies this censorship is always the bogeyman of Russia, right? All you have to do is say Russia, and then any amount of censorship, any canceling of candidates, redoing of elections, anything is justified because Russia.
You know, George, you know, you and I were at one time scholars of the communist movement of the Soviet Union a long time ago. All right. But we were, you know, and we've said it on this program before, is that, you know, this is the Sovietization of the European Union. I mean, the Soviet Union blocked foreign radio signals, okay, because they didn't want the so-called Soviet propaganda to impact their people. But it's the Europeans now that are creating all of the walls and not allowing their people to get other views. I mean, obviously, banning RT in the EU is the best example. But this is out of fear. It's not because they're right.
Yes, that's right. And in the glory days of the Cold War, the Western countries always felt very superior. Well, you can buy Pravda at any newsstand here. Sure. We don't ban Pravda. They, however, ban us. But it goes much beyond that. I mean, if you think about, well, what is the characteristic of a police state? Well, the police come knocking on your door and they say, we don't like the things you've been saying. You know, that people have told us you're saying all these bad things. You know, we don't like the things that you've been writing. You better watch it or you're going to end up in prison. Well, where is that happening today? Well, that's happening throughout Europe. In the UK, this is a regular thing. The police come knocking on people's doors. What crime have I committed? Your Facebook posts were offensive. People complained to us and they felt offended by what you said. In Germany, you said mean things about the chancellor. You better watch it or we're going to prosecute you. And people are prosecuted and people are sentenced to prison for nothing more than Facebook posts. So where is this happening? This is happening in Europe. It's not in Russia, in Europe. This is a police state. And what they have introduced is precisely that. You know, that you are censored and imprisoned for the things that you say. And then this is now, they did this explicitly with the Digital Services Act. In the UK, it's the Online Safety Act. And it is done, you know, they justify it by obviously child pornography, or hate speech, disinformation. But it's so all-encompassing that, you know, you can pretty much arrest and imprison more and more people. And things really do deteriorate in relations with Russia. There's going to be an awful lot of people getting arrested and imprisoned for.
I have to wonder, before we go to the break, Mark, I just have to wonder at what point you'll be persecuted for mentioning the Epstein files, because people will say that's anti-Semitism.
Well, it's also with their claims, the absolutely absurd claims that somehow Epstein was a Russian spy and a Russian honey trap rather than a Mossad Israeli one. I mean, that just goes to the point. But it has to be said that the same thing occurs in the United States.
Yes, a good point, Mark. Good point.
What people are being censored over is just different things. For instance, criticism of Israel or support of Palestine and other things. So, again, it's not principle. This is partisan warfare between the U.S. and Europe.
Well, I thought if we had done a segment that Russia was behind the Epstein saga, it would turn into a comedy segment, and this is not a comedy show. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Cross Like Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle Truenge. We're discussing some real news. And George, the news I want to talk about is that we have negotiations going on in Abu Dhabi and Oman. The two issues. I'm sorry, Mark. It's heartburn, I know, but I'll get to you. I guess Mark has already answered the question, so I can ask George another question. Anyway, one is the in Oman, we have the Americans and the Iranians negotiating, and I use that word very, very loosely or uselessly. And then, of course, in Abu Dhabi, we have what's going on, the trilateral, bilateral, the Ukraine conflict. You can see by my introduction in this question that my disdain for both processes. Take it away, George.
Well, you're right to have disdain. The Abu Dhabi talks are really unique in the sense that the only reason Russians and Ukrainians are taking part in these talks is to keep Trump happy. It's not like either party thinks that any of this is going to get anywhere, but they feel they have to keep Trump happy. So they send these delegations. And then after the talks, they announced that, yes, they were very productive, very constructive, and we're going to have another round of talks. I think the next one is scheduled for in Miami, you know, next week, you know.
Well, at least it's good weather, okay?
That's right. And so it's like there's no movement at all. They say, well, you know, Ukraine is being asked to give up territory in return for security guarantees. Well, we know that Russia's not going to accept the security guarantees. Zelensky is not going to give up any territory, so that's that. Then there's talk about, well, maybe we'll have elections in Ukraine. And the latest news is that Trump is imposing a deadline. So according to Zelensky, we have a June deadline to get a deal done. Well, okay. But according to Reuters, it's March is the deadline. So, you know, we went over the deadline. Now, in the face of the talks in Oman, well, that's really something that Trump has really brought this on himself. He's issued all of these threats. He's having the talks, but the talks clearly are not going anywhere because the demands that the Americans are making on Iran are just demands that Iran cannot possibly make. So, you know, there's obviously a deal to be done, a deal, something along the lines of the JCPOA. You know, the Iranians probably quite flexible. They could give Trump something. Okay, this is more advantageous to you than the JCPOA. We won't have a sunset clause or whatever. But what the Americans are demanding, like no enrichment, a limit on your ballistic missiles so that they won't reach Israel, no way in the world Iran is going to accept this. So, yeah, in both talks are obviously just destined to go nowhere.
But Mark, on this program, week after week, we have more negotiating ability and imagination than the entire U.S. State Department and the Trump administration. I mean, yeah, I think deals can be done. Will they be easy? Of course not. But it seems to me the Trump administration, they are antithetical to any real negotiation anywhere in the world. But where have we seen real negotiation? Threats is not necessarily, yes, it could be part of a negotiation. But that is the preamble to something else. We don't get much further from threats, Mark.
Yeah, the Trump administration likes to make a big deal out of how, unlike the Blinken-Sullivan administration, that they are completely willing to talk to anyone, right? And that's true, right? They do engage in talks, but those talks are Trump's threats and what will happen if you don't accept his deal. And that is, as you right said, it's not negotiations. It's mafia style threats, threats of leg breaking and so forth. And that's his idea of talking. And what's more, he doesn't even use his own State Department to conduct negotiations because he doesn't trust them, right? Marco Rubio is evidently perfectly capable of governing Venezuela and Cuba as neo-colonialist outposts, but they're not capable of conducting actual diplomacy, what you would think the Department of State is there for. Instead, Trump uses his own son-in-law and his real estate buddy, Steve Witkoff, whom, while they may not carry the same geopolitical ideological baggage as those in the State Department, in the blob, they have no competence. They have no real knowledge. They are not capable of carrying out serious negotiations at the level that is demanded by Russia and Iran. And it's quite obvious that the Trump administration has zero ability to bring its Kiev regime proxy to heel. And in fact, it's not even clear that Trump can bring the CIA to heel.
Well, okay, you're bringing up, let me throw it to George here. Mark is making reference to a high level would-be assassination of a Russian military figure. Thankfully, the man survived.
A negotiation figure.
Thank you, Mark. A negotiation figure. This is kind of the Israelization process of American foreign policy here. I mean, you know, I've often asked Russians, where does your patience come from? And now I'm at the end of my rope. Okay. I mean, this is obviously Western intelligence involved in this to one degree or another. And Trump wants to have a negotiations, and you're killing the, or attempting to kill the negotiators. Then this is a fraud. I'm sorry, George.
It is, and it's very, very strange act to undertake. I mean, you know, it failed, and the culprits have now been arrested. They've been brought to Moscow. So, but even if it had succeeded, it's hard to see what would you have achieved. I mean, somebody else is going to take his place. I mean, it's not going to change anything.
The talks.
Yeah, no, exactly. The talks would go on. Now, the Russian patience is a very odd thing, because the Russians have taken the stance that they like President Trump, they respect him, they will extend to him every courtesy. They will extend to him, you know, that they
Mark,
they
that's the public persona. Mark and George is right. That's the public pitch.
That's the public, but that's right. They say, you know, oh yeah, well,
my eye rolling detached right, my eyeballs.
Well, that's what they say in public. I mean, you know, you have to go by. You know, Lavrov said this. Yeah, Lavrov gives innumerable interviews, news conferences. So he always says this, that unlike the Europeans, unlike the horrible warmongering Europeans, the Trump administration is very serious about bringing this to an end. Now, in practical terms, you know, the Russians aren't giving Trump anything, but other than the whole process, yes, absolutely, we will go where you want us, and we will negotiate. But nothing comes out of that. So, but the Russians do want to make this distinction between the terrible Europeans and the apparently, you know, serious about peace Americans.
But the outcome, Mark, unless there is a major shift in approach when it comes to the Iranians, then conflict in one form or another, in my mind, is inevitable. When it comes to the Ukraine talks, this is a safe phasing process of, well, it's not settled. The conflict hasn't been settled in a day. No one said what day it was going to be. They're at loggerheads. And as long as they're talking, the battlefield will eventually determine the outcome of this conflict. And that suits just about everybody right now, because there's no one party that's going to make any major concessions. And Trump doesn't seem to have the political will or foresight to rein in the Zelensky regime here. And that's to his detriment. Mark.
Not only does he not have the ability to rein in the Kiev regime or the Europeans, but apparently his own intelligence.
His own intelligence.
Because as far as the Russians are concerned, there was just an attempt to assassinate the Russian president and his family at Valdai by intelligence agencies, which the New York Times, the CIA brags that they rebuilt the intelligence agencies and completely control them. And now during negotiations, there was an attempted assassination of not only one of the deputies of the head Russian negotiator, the head of the Russian military intelligence, Lieutenant General Alexeyev. He was a hero. He's a hero of the Russian Federation. He was involved in the affair that saw the surrender of the Azov neo-Nazis in Mariupol, which is why the Kiev regime hates him. And it must be remembered that this is not the first time that we have seen assassination of negotiators between Russia and Ukraine killed or attempted to be killed during talks by the Kiev regime. Because back in 2022, during the Istanbul talks, Denis Kiriev, one of the Kiev regime's own negotiators, actually an agent for their own military intelligence, was assassinated by a person from their other intelligence
agency. In broad daylight.
In broad daylight. Who's involved here? Is it internecine within the Kiev regime? Is it internecine in the U.S. regime between the CIA and the Trump administration? administration. From Russia's perspective, it doesn't matter. It's moot because they have to deal with the end results. They're attempting to psychologically manipulate Trump like everyone is within his own government and without, because that's what he wants. But that doesn't mean they're playing the game. They don't let it interfere with what's happening on the battlefield, where Russia is not just progressing, they're actually escalating.
And so, George, you know, I think that I've said this before on this program, but it seems to me a year from now, February of 2027, we're going to still be talking about this when it comes to Ukraine.
Well, I think so. And I think that nothing is going to come to an end anytime soon. And I think that Trump is going to be continuing doing these kinds of things along, you know, for some time, which is, well, I'm going to impose sanctions. You know, I'm really going to hit, you know, third countries. You know, and then walking them back. So we saw last week in the case of India, he was, you know, he said, well, I'm going to hit India with sanctions because they're buying oil from Russia. And then he walked it back and said, well, India's given me their word that they're not going to buy any more oil from Russia.
And so the Indians haven't said any. And the Indians haven't said anything.
The Indians have not said nothing. There's no statement whatsoever from Modi that we're not going to buy any more Russian.
Well,
we got our way.
Okay, I'm going to have to close this out. I hope, because of all of the frustration when it comes to Ukraine, that Trump wants to avoid taco and in fact end up attacking Iran, which we may be talking about next week. But in the meantime, I want to thank my guests in Moscow and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.